This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Just days away from our first-in-the-nation primary, the Democratic presidential candidates had one final New Hampshire debate on MSNBC last night. It was a spirited contest between Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, especially over the question of who's been most dedicated to core Democratic causes.
I represent, I hope, ordinary Americans, and by the way, who are not all that enamored with the establishment, but I am very proud to have people like Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva in the House, the co-chairman of the House Progressive Caucus.
Well, look, I've got to just jump in here because, honestly, Senator Sanders is the only person who I think would characterize me, a woman running to be the first woman president, as exemplifying the establishment. And I've got to tell you.
Meanwhile, in the Republican field, candidates made their last pitches across the state. Campaigning in Goffstown on Tuesday, Texas Senator Ted Cruz warned that Donald Trump is unfit to be president.
We need someone with judgment and the temperament to keep this country safe. I don't know anyone who would be comfortable with someone who behaves this way having his finger on the button. I mean, we're liable to wake up one morning and Donald, if he were president, would have nuked Denmark.
Also this week, New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan invoked Tuesday's primary in her final State of the State address.
This week, as our country's focus turns toward New Hampshire and our first in the nation primary, Americans will see that the state of our state is strong and getting stronger.
And some Granite Staters took a break from presidential politics to attend a debate of another kind over whether the state should allow bobcat trapping. The majority of people there were opposed, but Dan Dockham of Guilford said that to him, trapping is about recreation and history.
A lot of this feeling here to me is all emotional. It's simple. If you don't want to hunt them or trap them, don't. But don't stop those of us who enjoy this pastime and our heritage.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the week are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR. Josh, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, the final Democratic debate here in New Hampshire before the primary. And Josh, I'll turn to you first. How was this one different from earlier debates?
Well, the biggest difference was it was Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton head-to-head, no Martin O'Malley on stage. And, you know, it was a debate where the moderators, Rachel Maddow and Chuck Todd, really let them talk. And it was a substantive debate that covered lots of issues of importance to core Democratic voters. And it was interesting to hear Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders really tussle over, you know, how they're perceived within the party. I mean, certainly Sanders is casting himself as the more progressive and has suggested that you know, Senator Clinton is more of a or Secretary Clinton's more of a moderate. We got a lot of that, and you know, I thought it was an interesting debate to watch. It's hard to know whether it's going to change any minds, but it was certainly a substantive debate.
I do wonder about that, Dean Spiliotis, and Josh is absolutely right. A lot of the questions seem to focus on, you know, who is more equipped to handle the mantle of progressive Democratic causes. How much will hearts and minds be changed by this debate?
Hard to know. You know, whenever I think about this race, I think that, you know, the Clintons have been in and around New Hampshire for over 20 years now, going back to the 1992 Bill Clinton race for president. Bernie Sanders is from a state next door, has been a politician for several decades. And so you would think that people know both of these individuals very well. But it is true, if you look at the polling data, that a lot of people are still making up their minds. And New Hampshire is notorious for people deciding late. So I'm sure some people are just tuning in now and looking for differences. There was also a forum on Wednesday night in which each candidate got to speak for an hour, and I thought that was really interesting as well. It was a little bit less intense than the head-to-head debate that we saw last night. You know, I think Josh very nicely touched on the two key dimensions here. One is an internal ideological debate that is important to members of the party about, you know, who's the true progressive as the party has moved left. And, you know, we all know the Clintons used to be part of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was a very moderate to conservative group in the Democratic Party in the 90s. Now essentially defunct. So she's, you know, has she moved, or, you know, how much has the party shifted? So that's one debate. The second debate is the kind of insider-outsider, that, you know, Hillary Clinton is too captive to the establishment and to the financial interests of Wall Street and corporate America. And Bernie Sanders, even though he's been in Washington for several decades, is coming at it from the outside. So those are kind of the two classic dimensions. We'll see if it makes a difference. Hillary Clinton has a lot of ground to make up.
Well, real quickly, Dean, you know, there has been a lot written about how undecided Republican voters are. I think I saw something the other day that said, yeah, you know, 60% haven't made up their minds yet. What about Democrats, Dean?
Yeah, I can't recall the exact figure. Maybe one of the other gentlemen here will know. But I think it's at least 30 or 35%, something like that, if I'm recalling the latest figures. But it is not unusual to have people change their minds. And the other wild card are independent voters. What we've seen so far in the data is that on the Democratic side, these late deciders, independent voters, been leaning to Bernie Sanders in the Democratic race. And on the Republican side, they've been leaning towards Marco Rubio, which has led him to jump up into second place in the most recent MUR CNN poll.
Now, Gary, I know you've been busy at the State House this week with lots of legislation and Governor Hassan's State of the State address, and we'll get to that. But just your broad thoughts on this Democratic race as it's playing out here in New Hampshire, Gary.
Well, I think it's been a very intense race, particularly lately here. It's gotten much, much more heated than it was early on. It was very polite early on. While the Republicans were mixing it up, they weren't so much on the Democratic side. But I think, you know, it's sort of like a real look at the Democratic Party right now. I mean, for years, the Democratic Leadership Conference basically ran the party. And now, as we see Bernie Sanders and the kind of enthusiasm that he's generating on the other side, I mean, the progressive, or the left side of the party, if you will, is getting more energized than it has been in quite a while, I think. And that's what we're seeing, a really tug of war here going on.
1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Josh, before that very high-energy debate that we saw last night, there was an event earlier in the week, a forum in Derry, where the candidates appeared sort of not at the same time, one after the other. What was the sort of tone or feeling from that event?
Well, it was interesting to hear them talk, and it was a chance for them to talk at some length and you know, address a number of topics. I mean, you know, what I'm really watching in the next, you know, like 5 days, 4 days at this point is
it's coming up.
You know, what's going to drive the people to the polls? And, you know, one thing that is remarkable about Senator Sanders standing in the polls is that, you know, this is a guy who really only joined the Democratic Party this year, and that his ability to, it was perceived that he might be strong among independent voters, but the polling shows that he's leading Hillary Clinton among members of the Democratic Party. And, you know, today and tomorrow, the Clinton campaign has these events pegged to getting female voters out there. And that's another group of voters that is crucial in any race, but crucial in a Democratic primary in particular, that, you know, Sanders seems to have an edge among women voters, and that was, you know, arguably what allowed Hillary Clinton to beat then Senator Obama in 2008 was the sort of breaking of women voters at the end towards her. You know, the Clinton campaign has been focusing on abortion rights. They've had Billie Jean King up here. They've had Gloria Steinem up here. They're going to be canvassing all weekend long, and it's going to be very interesting to see if Hillary Clinton can close the gap among that group. It's also interesting to hear Hillary Clinton. I mean, this is somebody who won the primary the last time she competed here. The expectations game of the Clinton campaign is like, this is essentially where Bernie Sanders lives. And it's fascinating to watch the close on this one.
Well, and in that forum that you and I did with Secretary Clinton a couple weeks ago, Josh, she did mention, you know, gee, I'm a woman running for president. How much more anti-establishment does that get? We heard that line last night in the debate, Dean, as well, again saying, hey, that's pretty anti-establishment. What do you make of that attempt to appeal to women voters? Josh is right. Bernie Sanders has a fair number of female voters on his side as well.
That is right. I mean, he is, as Josh mentioned, he's way ahead among men, but he's slightly ahead, I think, 3 or 4 points among women. It's always been kind of a careful balance for the Clinton campaign. They occasionally will sort of roll that out to kind of remind people and kind of reinforce an accomplishment it would be to be the first women president, just like we've just had the first African-American president. On the other hand, they don't want to be seen as a women's candidate. I think there is some concern about that as well. Sometimes she highlights it, and then other times they kind of play it down. They don't want to be seen as asking for
favorite
treatment.
Tuesday, I think they're going to be
highlighted. For now, they will, right, exactly. Now, at this point. The big difference from 2008, I remember in 2008, Barack Obama was up, depending on the poll, somewhere between 8 to 11 points that last weekend, and she won. So I think they're realistic about closing what looks to be about a 20-point gap, but I think the race will tighten. And it is an expectations game. If they lose, they're going to want to be, you know, close, maybe 5 points, 8 points. And they're going to hit the favored son argument, even though I think that it's a little bit problematic given who Bernie is and given that he's from Vermont and not Massachusetts.
Yeah, the favorite son thing doesn't seem, when I, you know, hear from Bernie Sanders voters, nobody says, oh, I'm so comfortable with him because he's from Vermont. They like his ideals.
I don't hear the favorite son thing.
Well, I mean, I do think part of it is I think Dean makes a good point that it might be different if Sanders were from Massachusetts just due to the way the media markets work. I mean, the familiarity that we in New Hampshire have with people from Massachusetts, you know, by dint of the television stations and then in the newspapers is vastly different than our familiarity with people from Vermont. Right. And that was certainly the case when Howard Dean ran, too.
Yeah, and this is something I've actually spent a lot of time talking to people about over the last week. They're very, particularly reporters from outside of the state, they're very interested in this idea of Bernie, you know, being a favorite son. And, you know, having lived in the Connecticut River Valley, you do have a lot more of an influence from Vermont in that part of the state. But it's not the same as being from Massachusetts, like a Mitt Romney. Or even Paul Tsongas in 1992 when he ran against Bill Clinton. I think, you know, that's more of an issue. Plus, Clintons have been in the state for 20 years. They're a pretty well-known entity. So I think you have to take that favorite son argument you have to be sort of not careful not to overemphasize it. But they'll use it for sure if they lose.
Well, let's talk about the Republicans, gentlemen, and lots of candidates there. And probably voters are more undecided on that side because they have so many different choices to make. Josh, just to kick it off, just describe for us where this Republican race stands now. Here we are, final stretch. A couple candidates have dropped out. Post-Iowa, there's a lot going on.
Well, you could argue it stands largely where it stood for some time, which is kind of Donald Trump, kind of astride the field with a big edge. But you could also make the case that the result in Iowa where, you know, Trump obviously came in second and Rubio came in a close third has substantially shaken things up. I mean, the tracking polls post-Iowa suggest that, you know, there hasn't been a ton of movement, but it also suggests that there are a lot of people still trying to make up their minds. And so I've been out to a lot of Republican events this week, and, you know, it's fair to say that there are a lot of people who are still hardcore Donald Trump supporters. It's also fair to say that there are a lot of people who were supporting Trump, who are giving other candidates looks. I talked to a man yesterday who has a huge, you know, 5x7 Trump sign in his yard who says he may not end up voting for Trump. I talked to somebody who had two bumper stickers on his car, one, you know, for Trump, and then he's more recently put a Cruz sticker on top of Trump. there are a lot of people who are drawn to Rubio. I mean, Rubio hasn't spent a lot of time in the state until recently. And there are a lot of people who were intrigued by him. He was always sort of in the top three or four candidates for people. And now, after doing well in Iowa, people are looking at him. And then you have the more establishment figures, the governors, kind of they've been focusing on New Hampshire all along. And, you know, they will all suggest that their time on the ground here will pay off. It's kind of a muddle.
Well, the bumper sticker story is great. That's a lot of scraping once the once the campaign is over. Let's hear a little bit from Donald Trump speaking to supporters in Milford on Tuesday, reflecting on his second place finish in the Iowa caucuses.
One poll came out that said I was leading by 4 or 5 points, and I guess, you know, coming second. And the headlines were, Trump comes in second. He's humiliated. There were 17 people when we started. Now you have 11. I come in second. I'm not humiliated.
So there you go, Dean Spiliotis, not humiliated and campaigning actively in New Hampshire and states beyond.
That's right. There was about a not even a 48-hour period. I think it was about 36 hours, I calculated, where he was, you know, he gave that gracious speech in Iowa, and then he was sort of pretty quiet here. And then at about the 36-hour mark, we got the first tweets that said that Ted Cruz had stolen the Iowa caucuses from Donald Trump. So we were back in action. You know, they will say that they don't need to win here, but I do believe if Trump slides again into second place, let's say behind Marco Rubio or even Ted Cruz or maybe John Kasich, who's in fourth place in some polls, surprises people, or Bush, I think the other candidates will really be emboldened to start hitting him a lot harder. So there's a lot at stake for him. It's a better demographic for him in some sense because of the independent voters and others who are being drawn to the process because of him than was the case in Iowa. But we'll see. You know, he has not run by any means a conventional campaign. And people are now already sort of doing a postmortem on Iowa and saying, how would he have done if he had actually – he got the second most votes in Iowa caucus, Republican caucus history, or maybe even all caucuses, but – would have been different if he'd had a ground game. And that's the question.
Gary, do you want to jump in there?
I think, you know, it's kind of interesting that Trump really has built his whole campaign around this momentum from Iowa to New Hampshire and then onto the rest of the country. And it was a little sidetracked in Iowa. And, I mean, it doesn't look like he's going to get sidetracked here, but you never know. I mean, we were supposed to have a snowstorm. So, it's a toss-up.
I mean, the how dependable his support is a question that, you know, people were thinking we might get some answer on that out of Iowa. And it's true to Dean's point that, you know, Trump's not a natural fit with the, you know, more evangelical-leaning caucus voter base. While he does have some support from conservatives, you know, there was some polling out there, entrance polling that said, you know, 5% of caucus goers, Republicans, said that Trump shared their values. And that's, you know, if that's the case, it's remarkable in some ways he did as well as he did there. But if your campaign is predicated on your trajectory through life as being an unending series of victories, if you don't win, you know, it's going to raise questions. And it was interesting prior to I was at that Milford event where he said he was not humiliated prior to taking the stage with former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown at Hampshire Hills, you know, indoor tennis club where there were thousands of people fanned out over three tennis courts. He had a brief press conference. And at the press conference, he was like, well, you know, second place, I want to win New Hampshire, but second place would be fine. And it was a sort of a subdued presentation, you know, not on stage. It was, you know, back to the kind of profane, you know, hornet's nest kind of poking Donald Trump that people have gotten used to. But the question is when people have to decide, are they going to decide that they're comfortable with him, you know, as a nominee and as a potential president? And a lot of Republicans I've been talking to this week said, you know, maybe, but they're still making up their mind.
Wow, really interesting. Well, lots of attention this week on Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, because he had a strong showing in Iowa as well. Let's hear Marco Rubio praising the New Hampshire process and pushing back against the campaign rhetoric that we sometimes hear from Trump and Cruz.
It is not enough to be angry. You have a right to be angry, but anger is not a plan. And perhaps no state in the country demands more of their candidates than New Hampshire does, and you should. The role you play is so important.
So, Dean Spiliotis, anger is not a plan. Tease that out for us a little bit.
You know, Marco Rubio is running his own campaign. He is very hard to get him off message. He's very disciplined. He is being pounded relentlessly by Jeb Bush and particularly Chris Christie, who has a whole rap on him about being trapped in a bubble.
The boy in the bubble, being protected.
Yeah. So, you know, he's trying to just sort of stand off to the side and not get sucked in. His poll numbers are good enough that he can do that right now.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk about the governors, the three governors running, what they need to do this week. And we'll hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. As always, you can join us with your questions and comments about some of the big Granite State headlines of the week. Of course, the presidential primary. A little bit later, we'll talk about Governor Hassan's state of the state. And we'll also find out about the latest hearing on whether the state should reopen bobcat hunting. We'll talk about all that in a moment. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, let's just wrap up our conversation about the presidential primary. And, Josh, many commentators have talked about the governors, as you mentioned earlier, and what they need to do this week. Christie, Kasich, and Bush, what do you think they need to do in New Hampshire, Josh, in these last few days?
Well, I think that one of them, I think you need to get in the top three or four. You know, some of them, I mean, Bush potentially, who, you know, arguably has the lowest degree of enthusiasm on the ground of all of them, you know, may be better equipped to survive a little bit longer by dint of the money he has. But he's, you know, the that's being spent. You know, they need to get out there and demonstrate. I mean, New Hampshire is a place where, on paper, those sorts of guys could hold some appeal. They've spent a lot of time here. You know, they're going to need to demonstrate that on Election Day and then presumably get sort of a more national establishment support down the line. I mean, there are plenty of people in the Republican Party who fear that the nomination of Donald Trump or Ted Cruz will doom them and come general election. Who knows if that's the case? You know, the fact that Rubio came out of Iowa reasonably strong and looks like he could do okay here. You know, if he does well here, that may be bad for the three governors also. So it'll just be interesting to see, because once you know, second through fifth or sixth, you know, it's kind of anybody's ball game, it would seem.
And we do have the Republican debate on Saturday night. So, you know, at a minimum, I think, you know, one or more of the candidates would like to be the story coming out of that debate. And the other thing you want to do at this point is have really big rallies with lots of video of people waiting to get in to see you, because the kiss of death at this time before the primary is to have rallies where there are empty seats or a lot of space. You want to show there's enthusiasm, there's excitement, people are eager to see you as a candidate. You want to build that sense of momentum and hopefully peak right on Tuesday.
Well, and Gary, Chris Christie got a boost, I guess it was about a month ago or a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago, when your newspaper, the Union Leader, endorsed him. He seemed to be rising up a little bit. Now, what's your assessment of how Governor Christie fits in this governor group?
Well, certainly, I mean, he sort of hung his hat on New Hampshire, as have every one of the governors, really. I mean, they're cold campaigns are dependent on doing well here. And I mean, he's been spending a lot of time here. I mean, this week he got the endorsement of Sean Jasper as the House Speaker. I'm not sure what that does for you, really, but I mean, it makes for nice video. And I mean, he had a press conference where he said, "Thank you, Sean," and then proceeded to trash Rubio for the rest of the press conference, you know, called him every day is Groundhog Day in New Hampshire with the Rubio campaign.
Because he's scripted and says the same thing.
So, I mean, I think he's an interesting guy. I mean, he's probably the best, if you're a reporter, he's the best one to cover, because he's not scripted like the others and he can say anything. So you've got to sort of stay on your toes.
Well, and he also got the endorsement of Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. So he's got the top, you know, leading Republican and leading Democrat. Two leading Republicans, House and Senate, in the state.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing well in terms of the endorsements. I mean, and he's drawing pretty good crowds. But I mean, does that mean that Kasich isn't? Because Kasich is doing pretty well.
I mean, you can make the case that the governors have done very well by traditional metrics in terms of you know, people that are allegedly important endorsing them. But I mean, I say allegedly, you know, with due respect, but I'm not sure those things make any difference in this moment.
And now they're all concerned about Marco Rubio coming in, picking up a lot of late deciders after they've done all this, all this work here in the state for many, many weeks. And that's why he's being hit so hard. And, you know, it's conceivable one of those candidates might distinguish themselves, whether it's Kasich or Bush. Christie has receded a little bit, or it could just be kind of a wash where they all get 6, 7, 8, 9%. They've just kind of split the vote, and that's a possibility too.
And that is one thing that's kept Trump aloft. You look at the polling, and Trump may lead in the polls, but he's also the Republican that most Republicans say they will not vote for. Majority of Republicans. And so, you know, one thing that all these governors have been sort of duking it out, hoping that they will be the person who, you know, is left standing, who sort of claws out of the gutter, and then can be the beneficiary of the distaste for Donald Trump, but that's yet to happen.
Right. Which one will turn out to be the anti-Trump or the alternative to Trump? Let's hear a little bit from Chris Christie. Here he is after the Iowa caucuses, hitting the campaign trail here in New Hampshire. Lots of events on his schedule. And Chris Christie basically saying, okay, he didn't do well in Iowa, but optimistic that he will do well and that Donald Trump is fading.
The inevitability of the Donald Trump train has slowed down after last night. And everybody else is bunched within 2 points of each other. You all are going to make some big decisions this week, and I hope you make them in my direction. If you do, we'll win on Tuesday night.
Again, that's Chris Christie. Join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup as we wrap up some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. And, gentlemen, let's take a call. Dan joins us from Nashua. Hi, Dan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dan Weeks with the New Hampshire Rebellion. And as you all know, we're in the midst of what is projected to be a $10 billion election. And unlike any election past, we expect that money to come from. It is already coming from the tiniest of slices of American people, very, very wealthy donors. And we saw this issue of money in politics feature very strongly in the debate last night between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, as we've seen it in a lot of other debates. And I just wanted to mention and ask your guests to also comment on how they see Hillary responding to this issue, which has been such a drumbeat for Senator Sanders.
Well, let's talk about that, Dean Spiliotis. Yeah, that did come up a lot last night. Thank you, Dan, for calling in.
You know, there's no denying that there's a tremendous amount of money in the process this time around. I think there's a Bloomberg Politics study that came out recently that suggests that there's been $100 million spent in the state in New Hampshire, a lot of that for television ads. We've talked a lot about the super PACs. Hillary Clinton has had to deal time and again with Bernie Sanders' argument that she can't be a progressive because she has a super PAC. She takes big speaking fees from Wall Street. She has big donors. She has come back with her own argument about, 90% of her donors are small donors as well. You know, Sanders has set some records in that respect. But it's just, it's one of those things that a lot of candidates say they're opposed to all the money flooding the system, but they don't want to unilaterally disarm. Now, Sanders is a little unusual in that respect, and he makes a big point of saying that he doesn't have a super PAC. But is this going to be $3 to $5 billion election? Maybe it's just a it's just an astounding amount of money compared to even just a couple cycles ago.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, there are super PACs spending on Sanders' behalf, however. And it was interesting last night during the debate when the question was put to him, okay, Senator Sanders, this is a big deal for you. There is a public financing option.
Right.
And,
point.
You know, what's up with that? And he basically said, it wouldn't work. It's antiquated and you would lose. And, he's probably right.
Yeah. It's also become a sign of that. It's become a sign of weakness to have to take federal funds at this point. There was a time where it was almost unheard of to opt out of that system. George W. Bush did it quite visibly in the primaries in 2000. And then Barack Obama in 2008 did it in the primaries and the general. And ever since then, it's been seen as a viability. It's a sign of viability that you don't need that federal money. So I just think that system is broken.
Well, Dan, thank you for the question about money and politics. And here's an email on that same topic. Mark from Epping says, if, as Bernie Sanders says, large amounts of money spent by super PACs corrupt democracy, why is no one talking about the money being spent by labor union super PACs who are supporting the senator? Here is one example. National Nurses United, the largest nurses union in the U.S., the group endorsed Sanders for president back in August. Its political arm, National Nurses United for Patient Protection, has spent over $500,000 supporting Sanders as of December 2015. And Mark, our emailer, cites an Atlantic Magazine article from December of 2015. So, Dean Spiliotis, Sanders is getting outside money.
Right. It's just not of his own, sort of not directly linked to him, though. But, yeah, he is absolutely. And labor and unions are a big battleground among Democrats. You know, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders has been hitting Hillary Clinton on her support of her initial support of the TPP, the trade deal, and now she's backed away from it. She's also backed away from the Keystone Pipeline. But in any event, yeah, the labor unions are in the middle of Democratic politics. They have been. And this is an example of the process having a lot of outside input from other organizations beyond just the candidates.
Yeah, Gary?
Well, I mean, as Mark pointed out, I mean, it's $500,000 from a labor union as opposed to how many millions from various other people. I mean, labor unions have been dwarfed after this Citizen United decision in terms of money that they put into these campaigns.
And Josh, last thoughts from you. I know you have to hit the campaign trail, but anything else that you want to mention that you may expect here in the Granite State over the next how many days? I'm losing track. Four?
Don't put me on the spot. I guess I would say that it'd be interesting to watch the debate and see if something happens on that shuffles things a little bit more on the Republican side. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what kind of weather we get on Tuesday and how that affects people's ability to get their voters to the polls. I mean, the sort of so-called ground game on the Democratic side is sort of easier to see than what's gone on the Republican side this time.
So many candidates.
And so that's what we'll be watching.
Well, Josh, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care. That's Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, again helping us wrap up the presidential primary here in the Granite State. You can join us with your questions and comments throughout the hour. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. With us now is NHPR Sam Evans Brown with an update on the debate over whether the state should allow bobcat trapping. There was a big hearing earlier this week. And Sam, you know, we've talked about this before, but just remind us, what's the proposal on the table? Where's it coming from?
So where it's coming from, it's probably pretty safe to say that it's coming from the fact that there are trappers in the state who for a number of years have been seeing more and more bobcats in the woods and have been pushing the Fish and Game Commission saying, hey, you know, this population has started to come back. Maybe we could reinstate the bobcat season, which was closed in the late 80s because the population had really crashed at that time. And so the Fish and Game Commission undertook a study, which started back in 2008, 2009. There were sort of three studies that built on each other and finally came to a conclusion about a year ago where they came up with a sort of rough estimate for how many cats they think are in the state. And they took that number and sort of ran with it and said, okay, here's the reproductive rate of the bobcats. Here's how many we think we're going to have each year. And therefore, we can take, we can trap, hunt, kill this many bobcats per year and still see the population grow based on the best available science that we have. And that was the foundation for the rule that's now being commented on.
Wow. So this has been studied for a while, Sam. I didn't realize they've been looking at this for many years, it sounds like.
Yeah, indeed. And when the study actually was first proposed, animal rights activists, the folks who are now really incensed about this, sort of saw where it was going back then. And so it's been building for a long time.
So it's trapping, Sam, not shooting bobcats, just trapping?
Is that correct? It's a two-month season. The month of December would be for trapping, and the month of January would be for shooting. And typically bobcats are hunted with dogs by hounding, where the dogs chase the cat up a tree and they're shot in the tree.
You reported this week, Sam, that sentiment at the hearing was running pretty strongly against the hunt. What were those folks saying?
So public opinion is really tough to gauge in public hearings because obviously it's the most activated folks who show up. Down here in Concord, it was about 85% of – I mean, there were around 600 people who showed up. It was really
– Really?
It was,
wow.
It was a huge crowd. It was really – I mean, I've never seen that many people in the State House for just, a fish and game proposal, right? So about 85% of those people were in opposition. However, the next night in Lancaster, so in the North Country, there were about 100 folks in attendance, and they were mostly in favor of the hunt. We've also got a poll that was done by the Humane Society, but the language of that poll was really sort of pushing the respondents towards opposition. I mean, really graphic language about the methods used for the hunting, and that was like 79% in opposition. So it's tough to say. It does seem like most folks who hear about this are not in favor, but it is very hard to say. And the concerns are really just, you know, why does this need to be done? This is not a nuisance species, and just sort of general antipathy towards hunting is, I think, what's driving it.
Well, we've got some Facebook comments on this, and here's one from Caroline who says, not only is it unwarranted, but trapping is such a vicious and cruel way to do it. I could understand seeking to shoot a predator that is directly hunting and threatening livestock, but not the indiscriminate cruelty of trapping them because they're there. It seems like some folks, Sam, do have a problem, especially with trapping, where the animal is stuck. And, you know, it could be a long, painful death.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, it's interesting. There was actually just an article that came out not long, you know, a couple weeks ago about trapping of bobcats in Nevada. And there are, you know, there is what they call bycatch, where you sometimes get the wrong species. There have been all sorts of animals that wind up in trappers' traps. And in fact, there already are around, you know, 6 to 12 bobcats a year are killed by trappers accidentally who are aiming for other species, fisher, beaver, you know, I'm not exactly sure what kind of traps get bobcats. But so it is a hunting method that a lot of people find distasteful, and trappers are very aware of that and sort of, you know, don't like to come out of the shadows to talk about it because they know that no matter what, they're going to be seen in a negative light because of their methods.
Well, Scott also put a comment on a Facebook page. He says, after growing up in New Hampshire, I find I now live in a state that hunted, killed, and wiped out anything with pointy teeth. It is now overrun with pests and vermin, normally hunted by predators. Don't do it, New Hampshire. This is a big mistake. Did you hear that argument too, Sam, at the hearing that, rats or, I don't know, whatever types of vermin you want to talk about, that bobcats could actually help us keep those populations down?
That argument definitely was made. The connection to Lyme disease was made by some of the opponents. You know, if you've got lots of vermin, they have, you know, they have ticks on them.
Because mice are carriers.
I'm not sure that there's any real evidence to support that that's the case or that bobcats are you know, the classic prey of a bobcat is the snowshoe hare or the cottontail rabbit, which, you know, there are not many of left in the state. So they've become
threatened too.
Right. They've become a real opportunist species. They've been eating a lot of turkeys, we've been told. They do catch mice and squirrels and things like that. It's not clear to what degree they would be a real, you know, substantial control on those vermin, quote unquote, species.
Well, and Sam, you reported again that here in Concord, the hearing was very much anti-hunting of bobcats. There's a hearing in the North Country coming up, as I understand.
No? It already happened. It was the
already
day
happened.
After.
Yeah, okay.
And as I said, it was more in favor of trapping. It was, you know, the union leader was there. I was not. They reported that the majority were in support of trapping up there.
Okay. So what's next in this whole process, Sam?
Next, the Fish and Game Commission will take the input that they've received. Maybe they'll modify the proposal. Maybe they won't. And then they'll take a vote on it at their next meeting. And we'll see what they do with it. I mean, it's not at all clear to me to how much it matters that there's this sort of groundswell of opposition.
Okay. Sam, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
NHPR's environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown updating us on the debate over whether bobcat hunting should be allowed in the Granite State. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we head into the break, gentlemen, Gary Reno, real quick question for you. You've been in New Hampshire a long time. I'd love your thoughts on this bobcat discussion and how it reflects sort of the changing demographics and ethos of New Hampshire.
Well, I when you talk about the bobcats, I look back at hunting deer, and there was a big controversy probably about 15 or 20 years ago about hunting down in Rockingham County, and somebody wanted to ban deer hunting in Rockingham County. And I mean, it was this surge of, well, this is a tradition, we've had it here forever and ever. But I mean, Rockingham County had changed. There are houses everywhere. It was very few farms and fields and so on. And I think it's the same way here. I mean, we've had a huge change in the demographics of the state, where a lot of the people who are moving in here now, who have actually even lived here for a decade or two, are not from here, haven't grown up with people living next door who trap for a living. I mean, and very few of us live next door to anybody who traps for a living now. It's a whole different ballgame, and that's why we have a whole different mindset, both nationally and the presidential primary in our local politics as well.
All right. Well, coming up, we will talk about the governor's State of the State address. That was also happening this week. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you as we catch up on some of the top news of the week, from the presidential primary to Governor Hassan's State of the State address. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's talk about the State of the State address. Dean Spiliotis, you and I covered this yesterday together. What were some of the big messages that Governor Hassan presented in this speech?
Yeah, well, you know, the expectation was, since this is her last State of the State, it would be a bit of a valedictory. She would kind of go back over sort of back over the highlights and still hit some of the key issues that she's still concerned about, like Medicaid expansion. You know, her kind of big ticket arguments over the last couple of years have been this idea of innovation in the workforce. So in the speech, she talked a lot about various programs designed to help our workforce in the state be more competitive and more successful. She talked a lot about bipartisanship. You expect outgoing governor to talk about leaving the state in better shape than when she got it. She, of course, did that. And, you know, she threw in some of the other kind of Democratic politics issues, like the minimum wage, which I think was just actually defeated in the Senate yesterday here in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be a big issue for Democrats in the fall. She talked a little bit about ISIS and terrorism, which you expect for somebody who's going to run for the U.S. Senate. You know, but all in all, it was primarily a wrap up. No big major surprises in terms of programs going forward.
Gary, you were there. Go ahead.
Well, I think there was the only one really one new program that she really talked about, which was this Gateway to Work.
Gateway to Work, right.
Which basically is TANF, for which is temporary aid to needy families, or what we used to call welfare funds. Uses some surplus funds, which is about $20 million of surplus funds. The whole program won't use that, but that's what's available. And to use this money to sort of target families at risk and people on TANF and on a Medicaid expansion to put them into jobs where there is a real need, such as healthcare jobs and things like that, where they can have a really decent salary and get off welfare, et cetera. I mean, and the question is, if you've got $20 million surplus, then probably there aren't that many people on welfare right now. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting. But I mean, a lot of it's already in place. What I guess is the new part about this is there are a lot of partnerships that they've gone out and gotten with places like Dyne and New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and so on.
Well, and Dean, picking up on what you mentioned about the overlay of the U.S. Senate right. race in this speech, a lot of people were listening for some national themes. There wasn't that much of it in this speech, but let's hear a little bit since you mentioned it, Dean. Here's Governor Hassan at one point addressing national issues like gun violence and terrorism.
From the evolving and unique threats posed by the likes of ISIS and other terrorist organizations, to the increasing acts of gun violence and mass shootings across the country, we must continue to be vigilant in our efforts to keep our communities safe and secure.
So that was one point, Dean, where she was raising some U.S. Senate race-sounding yeah. themes. Were there other yeah. points, though, Dean?
Well, other than the kind of safety and security, she did mention ISIS and terrorism. The gun reference, obviously, gun violence has been an issue that Kelly Ayotte has been hit on some of her votes in the Senate dealing with various aspects of gun control. And then the other aspect of it really is kind of setting up the Democratic economic agenda, resonating a lot with what you're also hearing in the presidential race about – you know, income inequality, giving people the appropriate public education and opportunity through these various workforce programs. And then obviously the minimum wage, which has, you know, been a central point of contention between Democrats and Republicans at every level of government pretty much. So those are sort of the two things, a little bit on security to kind of set up the debate with Kelly Ayotte, and then sort of classic Democratic themes about job training, education, and economic opportunity.
Well, I want to talk to both of you about the Republican response to the speech. But to kick that off, I want to play a little bit from our interview yesterday, Dean, with Senator Jeb Bradley, again, Republican from Wolfboro and the Senate Majority Leader. After the address, he said, look, many of the successes that Governor Hassan touted were actually due, he said, in large measure to efforts in the legislature. Let's hear.
We did put together great budgets, but let's remember she spoke against both of them, vetoed one of them. Thankfully, we did come together after a huge amount of work in the legislature on passing heroin and opioid-related legislation. And I think, you know, the verdict's out on what's going to happen on Medicaid expansion.
So, Gary Reno, there's Jeb Bradley saying, okay, all those things she mentioned are worth celebrating, but let's give the legislature some credit for
that. Well, I mean, she talked about bipartisan budgets and so on, and we all sort of rolled our eyes a little bit seeing how she vetoed the budget last time around. But, I mean, you get what Jeb doesn't tell you is an awful lot of, like, what's in that budget was actually what she proposed originally. And, I mean, so, you know, it's if you go kind of halfway in between, both of them is probably where you really want to look. I mean, a lot of what the drug stuff that came out, for example, I mean, a lot of that came actually from the drug czar, who's now gone, some of his proposals. I mean, it's a two-way street, you know, and it's a give and take in the legislature. It's the legislature and the governor. I mean, you don't get anything through if you don't cooperate, and you have to cooperate both ways. I mean, right now we're in a very highly charged partisan environment as we're heading into the election year, and so everybody's going to play it in a very partisan way.
What are your thoughts, Gary, on Medicaid expansion? We did a whole program on that earlier this week. Senator Bradley mentioned it in that clip we just heard. There seems to be bipartisan support for doing it in a Republican way.
In a Republican way, I mean, they've made a few little tweaks on it. To be honest, some of these little tweaks aren't going to pass the CMS. They're not going to get the waiver on the job.
The Federal Center for Medicaid Services.
They're not going to get some of these things that they want. Somebody described them to me as window dressing to get it through the House. And I think that's basically what it is. You have a few of these things that the Republicans want, so it goes through the House. But I think most Republicans realize that they have to get something through here. You just don't throw 50,000 people off of health coverage. And you don't stop taking $500 million of federal money every year that's coming into the state and helping the economy overall, particularly through the healthcare industry.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Dean.
I was gonna say, you know, two of her biggest moments as governor, I think, have been pushing for these special sessions, one on originally on Medicaid expansion and now more recently on the opioid crisis, which the two have also been linked legislatively. With a number of these opioid bills that were fast-tracked have now been passed. Some of them need to go to the House. She's pushed very hard, and it is true, as Gary said, that I think back over the last several years of her time as governor, and it is often the case she's very good, and I've said this before politically, at talking about accomplishments as a sign of kind of bipartisanship and her ability to work together. And then you hear from Republicans, well, you know, it's basically our bill or it's basically our initiative. You remember the first budget, which passed the Senate unanimously, and she gave this sort of big speech about bipartisanship, and Republicans in the Senate said, well, it's our budget. So that's an important political asset. I do think, unlike a lot of the polarization we're hearing in the presidential race, the Senate race to some extent is going to be a little bit more about the center. You've already heard Kelly Ayotte kind of repositioning herself on a number of issues. So I think in contrast to the presidential race, we may be hearing a little bit more about bipartisanship and problem solving.
Interesting. So in the presidential race, Dean, we're hearing who can be the most progressive or liberal on the Democratic side and who can be the true conservative on the Republican side.
No one's talking about bipartisanship or compromise. But you are hearing some of those. And those are pretty typical themes, actually, which is why this presidential race is so unusual. And I do think you will hear more of that from Governor Hassan and Senator Ayotte in the summer.
Well, you mentioned, Dean, how Governor Hassan and many other politicians on both sides of the aisle have linked this idea of Medicaid expansion with the need to address substance abuse treatment. Let's hear Governor Hassan talking about that in her speech yesterday.
New Hampshire has for too long lagged behind other states for treatment capacity. That's one of the many reasons why we must reauthorize the bipartisan New Hampshire Health Protection Program without delay.
Again, that's Governor Maggie Hassan in her State of the State speech yesterday. You can join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Gary Reno, in the Senate yesterday, there was discussion on a package of opioid-related bills. Right. Remind us what happened.
Well, there were three bills. One was drug courts, establishing drug courts statewide. Another one is a grant program for law enforcement, which would use matching money to set up programs like Granite Hammer down in Manchester, which targets high crime areas at certain peak times of the day. And the third one with the money to upgrade the state's prescription drug monitoring program. And that was all well and good. But what they really argued and fought about was about this provision for sending $5 million to the state's rainy day fund. And Democrats were saying, well, if we got $5 million extra dollars, then we ought to be putting it into treatment and recovery programs. And Republicans were basically saying, but we need to put this money in there in case we have something down the road, that we have problems. We need to be sure that we have enough money to deal with them. And it was about an hour's worth of debate over this. And I mean, in all honesty, this is probably an issue that Democrats will be using in the coming election. We wanted more money for it. The Republicans wanted to put the money in a safe.
Well, and it's been interesting how this very real concern about opioid addiction, how to address it here in the Granite State, has filtered up to the presidential candidates, right, Dean? We've heard them talk a lot about this, Republicans and Democrats. Chris Christie has been eloquent on this, you know, Bernie Sanders and so forth.
Well, you know, these presidential candidates are always looking for ways to connect with New Hampshire voters. And so you've heard a number of these candidates talk about their own experiences with family members who have struggled with addiction. It's a way to kind of connect with people who have had it in their lives as well. And yeah, you hear about it not only in New Hampshire in campaign ads and in debates, but in other parts of the country as well. You'll still hear the candidates reference back to New Hampshire on this issue.
Well, let's hear from Bernie Sanders. This is at a CNN town hall forum in Derry on Wednesday. So not a debate, but a sort of side-by-side appearance, or one after the other appearance. Here's Senator Sanders talking about substance abuse recovery services and what he would do.
And when I talk about moving toward universal health care, what I understand that to be, and it is absolutely imperative that it be, is understanding that mental health and addiction is part of health care. And what that means is that when people need treatment, they shouldn't have to wait 3 months. When they need it, they should be able to get it. So that means we need a revolution in this country in mental health care to address the causes of addiction and provide treatment.
And again, so there's Senator Sanders kind of melding the national, his own campaign for universal health care or Medicare for all with New Hampshire's very real concern.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, we, here in New Hampshire for a number of years, we've talked about, you know, the issues with funding the mental health system in the state and problems with that in terms of access to facilities and treatment, both for mental health and addiction. So this has been something that is, it's not unique to New Hampshire, but it is interesting to see, even in a state that's sort of, you know, doing well by national standards in terms of education and prosperity, you still have these sort of really serious issues with drug abuse.
And you know, the other thing is he's talking about the mental health ought to be treated the same as physical health. I mean, and frankly, we've had laws here in New Hampshire and federal level where you have parity between the two. I mean, that's the federal law. Whether that's reality or not is another story. I mean, we have the AG investigating some of the insurance companies in New Hampshire because they don't seem to be doing that.
Well, and at that forum in Derry on Wednesday, Secretary Clinton was asked by a New Hampshire voter about another issue that we've talked a lot about here in the Granite State, medical marijuana. So here's Hillary Clinton saying she would start with more research, but then keeping in mind the opioid drug epidemic. So kind of raising both of these issues that have been salient here in the Granite State.
I have no doubt that there are very real benefits for people. We know in chemotherapy, we know from other conditions, in using the right amount of the right kind of marijuana. I just want to make sure it's the right amount and the right kind. That's why I want to get that research up and going as quickly as possible. But you said something else, which I think is really important. We can't be here in New Hampshire and not talk about the addiction problem in New Hampshire, not talk about the fact that there have been more deaths by overdoses than car crashes in this state, not talk about the lives that are being destroyed, the people that I meet, the grandmothers raising their grandchildren because they've lost their children.
Again, that's Hillary Clinton at that forum in Derry on Wednesday night. And so, Dean, let's pivot back to the Republicans. They've got that big debate. Josh Rogers mentioned that earlier on Saturday night. Yep. Carly Fiorina will not be on the stage.
Right.
Everybody else will. She's understandably pretty upset about that.
Yeah, and I think just either today or yesterday, you know, Kelly Ayotte came out and made a statement about that as well. You know, this has been an ongoing issue for the Republican candidates, given the size of the field. You know, we used to have the undercard debate or the happy hour debate or whatever
kids
you want to call
debate.
It. Kids table. Yeah, all these sort of snarky names for it. But the reality is just too many people to have on a single stage. So there's been a constant debate over the criteria to get you into that debate. I believe this is an ABC debate, I think, on Saturday night. And for whatever reason, she did not meet their threshold. So she's being excluded, even though, you know, she competed in Iowa and I believe got at least one delegate or some delegates. She's not going to be allowed in. So, you know, it sort of is what it is. It makes it difficult for her, and you know, that's less visibility. And in that debate, I'm someone who's very careful not to overemphasize the impact of debates, but it's like your last best chance before voting on Tuesday. So to be excluded from that, I think, is really unfortunate for her.
So there'll be seven people on that stage. And I heard her say this morning in an interview with NPR, Marketplace, actually, she said, look, can't they just put one more podium up there?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How hard would it be?
You know, on the other hand, we saw last night with the head-to-head debate, it's just a completely different dynamic. But you're right. We have had seven. What's one more podium? But unless there's some last-minute fix to this, she won't be on the stage Saturday night.
Gary, anything happening at the State House next week, or are they just shutting down and letting the presidential primary run everything?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. The House is closing down on Tuesday for the primary, but the Senate is not. And one of the bills that the Senate is taking up is Senate Bill 551, which is casino gambling.
Oh, my goodness. A favorite topic in the New Hampshire State Senate.
We'll need something after the primary to talk about.
I mean, and you can question whether what the scheduler had in mind when they put it on the day of the primary. Maybe they're trying to bury it. Who knows what's going on?
All right. Gary, thank you so much for being here. We know it's a real busy time for you. We always appreciate your time.
Great to be here, Laura.
Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Dean Spiliotis, buckle your seatbelts for the next week. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. This is The Exchange on NHPR.